Welcome, everybody. OUJLIC at Queens College is proud to welcome Dr. David Pelkovitz to our campus. Dr. Pelkovitz's lecture is graciously organized by the Rabbi Isaac Elkanah Theological Seminary and Yeshiva University's Campus Speakers Bureau, providing Rosh Yeshiva, faculty, administration, and alumni of YU to college campuses in North America, and primarily focusing on OUJLIC campuses like ours here at Queens College. Dr. Pelkovitz is a professor of psychology and the Strauss Chair of Psychology and Jewish Education at the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education Administration at Yeshiva University, serving for more than two decades as Director of Psychology at North Shore University, NYU School of Medicine, and Clinical Professor of Psychology at NYU School of Medicine. Dr. Pelkovitz has consulted extensively with the Jewish community in the United States, Europe, and Israel on a wide range of issues facing children and adolescents. Dr. Pelkovitz, who received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, has published and lectured extensively on a variety of topics. That's what's on the page. On a personal note, I'm like so excited to have Dr. Pelkovitz here with us on campus. When I was in my senior year, I needed a couple more psychology classes to finish my major, and I spent all the time, and you all know what it's like to go through campus administrative paperwork, to be able to take a class with Dr. Pelkovitz in the Azrieli School while I was still an undergrad to make sure that I got a chance to learn from Dr. Pelkovitz. I got to learn with him a couple of more times afterward. He's also a part of training REITs, rabbinic students when they're becoming rabbis in terms of pastoral counseling and issues. He's amazing, dynamic. He's brilliant both in the realm of psychology and Torah. He's incredibly funny. No pressure. and he has great stories, which is just rough for me because when I give chaburas going forward, I won't be able to quote Dr. Pelkovitz's stories. You'll have heard them firsthand with a lot more pizzazz. But it is my honor and pleasure to welcome Dr. Pelkovitz to our campus and to address us today.
Thank you for the beautiful introduction, Robert Sharnoff. Yeah, a lot of pressure there. I can't deliver on the funny guys, okay? I can't, okay? If you try to be funny, you can't be funny, okay? I could sing. You want me to sing? I could tell jokes, but that has to just come. Okay, psychology of change. What I'm going to talk about, and I'm so amazed with this turnout, but it's in a way what I'm talking about. It's the power of this time of year. And I'm going to talk about four ingredients in the psychology of change. I'll bounce a little bit off of the research, a little bit off of Divrei Chazal, and stories as well. Okay. The first part I'm going to talk about is based on the word Elul as search. So I don't know if you know that Elul is Aramaic for a search process. If you look in Shlach, the first pasuk in Shlach, Yasuru es haaretz, the Targum says, Unkela says, Yalula. So first I want to talk about what does the search process have to do with the psychology of change? And the answer is pretty much everything. You know that the Piazessner in both in pre-Holocaust Europe, but also in the horrible years when he led the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto and continued to teach there, he would do six-month goal setting with his students. So he'd sit down with every one of his students individually and say, this was obviously before those horrible years when it was clear that it was very hard to plan for the future, but he would sit down with students and say, where do you want to be 6 months from now? Where do you want to be, ideally, in terms of your learning? Where do you want to be in terms of your development as a human being? Where do you want to be professionally? And he'd keep their eye on the ball because there's a tremendous power to that search process. And that's the first point I wanted to talk about, is the power of clarity that these 40 days are about. As an example, what research in positive psychology shows is that if I asked all of you to spend the next 20 minutes, write down, don't worry about grammar, don't worry about spelling, don't even worry about anybody reading it, just write down, where do you want to be 10 years from today? Right? The few days, actually yesterday was the birthday of the world, so now it's I think 5 days before Rosh Hashanah, right? So where do you want to be 10 years from now? During this week in Tuf Shin, whatever it is, 10 years from now, okay? 2025. This week in 2025. This is going to be Tuf Shin Ayin Vav. I guess you had the pay, so Tavshin Peivav. Where do you want to be? But where do you want to be in terms of the best possible outcome for yourselves personally? Best possible outcomes for yourself professionally? What are your dreams? What are your aspirations? There's this guy, Michael Josephson, who writes about this issue in the secular world. You know, he has a great imagery. He says, this is how you have to live your life. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at your own funeral after 120 years. And think about the three ways that you most want to be remembered when you're eulogized after a hopefully long and productive life. He says, think of the three ways that you most want to be remembered in terms of your goals and aspirations going forward. But he says, think about that and then live life backwards. Live life backwards. It's a powerful, powerful psychological part of the year. So then, let's go back to the exercise that I'm talking about. So if I had you write about the dreams and aspirations 10 years from now in terms of best possible outcomes, I had you do it today, I had you do it tomorrow, I had you do it Motzei Shabbos, and I had you do it Sunday, 4 days in a row. You know what the research shows will happen to you? Two things will happen. Your happiness levels will shoot up, probably for a couple of months, not forever, but for a couple of months, because you're getting in touch with the essence of who you are. When we take out the Torah as Yom Kippur night in a short few weeks, what does Liyishrei Lev Simcha mean? It means the straight of heart. Simcha comes from being connected to your inner self, your inner spark, your signature strengths. Whereas the Chazon Ish said, for he who knows the light of truth, there's no sadness in the world. So when you get in touch with your goals, when you practice the Yalula, it's happy making. But the other thing the research shows, it makes it more likely you'll realize those goals. When you have clarity about your goals, it says it in Mishlei beautifully. In Mishlei it says, Be'ein chazon yifara'am. Without that vision thing, it's very hard to hold on to your values. You literally need chazon. You need the goals. You need the step back response to understand how to live life backwards. Let me give you a study and a story and then end part one. Okay? Study, very basic study. The research shows that the many kids in the United States who get a Jewish education purely through Talmud Torah, going to a Talmud Torah, not going to a yeshiva. So let's say they go to a Talmud Torah or Sunday school or whatever it is, whatever frequency it is. The research shows if they stay in that kind of education, not a day school education, just that level of education, through their senior year of high school, intermarriage rates plummet. If they leave after their bar and bat mitzvah, like most kids do, there's a pretty high risk for assimilation. So somebody gave money to a team of researchers at Harvard to ask a very simple question. What differentiates the top 10 Hebrew schools that have the best retention through 12th grade from the bottom 10? Turns out it's not what you'd think. It's not the beauty of the building. It's not even the competence of the teachers. It's not the curriculum. You know what it was? The number one predictor was? It was all about goals. The first day of school, when you would enroll your preschooler in their Sunday school or in their Hebrew school, the head of the school would sit down and say, you know, this is no Mickey Mouse school. If you're sending your kid here, you're committing to sending him or her here through 12th grade. And they would knock that into the heads, manage that expectation right from the beginning, every year. Then as soon as the kids were old enough, they'd sit with the kids and say, look, we don't want you really, we want to have you in this school desperately, but you're committing, this is a real school. You're going to get a very deep exposure to Jewish education. Just that aspect of Elul, that Yalula aspect, made all the difference. That's the study. And here's the story before I move on to a quote and then the next three ingredients. Here's the story. Many years ago, I used to be young, by the way. I used to be your age even, okay? So when I was young, when I was first married, before we had kids, we had a relative about 4 or 5 hours from the New York City area. We used to like to go and visit with them. They were sort of fun. And we would go there on a pretty regular basis when we were younger and we could afford to take off a Friday and go driving on that 5-hour drive. And it was just sort of like a nice way to get away. It didn't cost us any money. We certainly didn't have any money. And The one thing, though, that was pretty amazing about when we went there was I would sit next to my relative in Shul there, and he sat in the back with a group of guys who were out-of-control talkers. They talked during Kedusha. When the rabbi got up to shush them up, they would talk even louder just to stick it to the rabbi. The rabbi had this whole thing about Animus Miros being very mystical and very, very important. So that's when they really would scream. Many of them today are famous men. Many of them became, one became extremely wealthy, the other became a very prominent figure in the secular community. These are famous guys, okay? But they were talkers. And after a while, we stopped going there. We had kids, we had careers, we weren't able to go there. About 10 years passed from the time last time I had been there. 10 years later, I had heard that my relative had started, him and the group of talkers had started a breakaway shul in a wealthy part of town. I thought they'd call the shul Anshei Medabrei Tefila. That would have been a bad name for the shul. And I thought, whoa, okay, I can't even imagine what kind of shul they're going to have. I don't know, you know, they might have cut out, what is it, JFK or FBR? JFK is going to shul just for Kiddush. So I thought maybe they just have Kiddush, you know, no davening. And what is FBR? From but robotic. So I thought this is going to be the ultimate at JFK FBR shul. Okay, I was positive. And I go there. My relative was the founding president of the shul's magnificent building. I don't know how many tens of millions of dollars it cost them. And I sit next to him Friday night, and the first thing that hits me is a wall of profound silence. You could touch the silence. I was amazed. So I bend over to him. I say, "What's going on here?" And the whole shul starts going, shh, like they're ready to kill me. They're literally ready to kill me. So I thought, oh my God, okay. I got to find out. I'm a curious guy. So I figure I don't know much necessarily about halacha. I do know, if you need to know what the kulas are in any area of halacha, what you're allowed to do, I know that stuff. Okay, you could come to me. I'll tell you the source and whatever. So I knew when you were allowed to talk on Friday night. So I wait for that point. I was ready to quote, you know, the Shulchan Aruch and where it says you're allowed to be whatever. And I bend over to him. I say, "What's going on?" Again, the whole shul's ready to kill me. So I figure I'm not getting the answer in shul. I wait till we're walking home. I wasn't sure if I was even allowed to talk walking home. But walking home, I ask him, "What's going on?" And here's what he said. And this is the way I'll conclude the goals section of this, okay? Except for one quote. He said, "Look, we broke away and started a new shul. We put a lot of our own personal money into building a new building. And we hired a rabbi. Credible rabbi. We thought to ourselves, for the first time in our lives, you know something? We're throwing everything into this shul. What's davening all about? What's a shul all about? We never thought about it. For us, we were just like primed to rebel against rabbi as authority figure. So we started learning with the rabbi about what's the goal of tefillah? What's the goal of a shul? What's davening about? And the more we learn, the more we realize, wow, we really messed this up. And we have to make a difference." You know what they did? They built into the DNA of the shul, into the fabric of the shul, the following agreement. If you wanted to be a member of that shul, you didn't have to go to that shul. There were other shuls to go to. You had to sign a contract that said, "Here's how much money I'm going to give for membership dues every year, and here is a commitment that I am making a solemn promise. I will not talk during davening." You know, I've been back there. This was maybe 30 years ago, and I go back there every once in a while. Still, the quietest shul I know of. Seriously quiet shul with a beautiful davening. Be'ein chazon yifara'am, elul is search. And I'll just end with a quote from a guy named Benjamin Mays, the president of Morehouse College, going back about 60, 70 years ago. And then I'll move on to the next three ingredients. Here's what he says. "It must be borne in mind that the tragedy in life doesn't lie in not reaching your goal. The tragedy lies in having no goal to reach. It isn't a calamity to die with dreams unfulfilled, but it is a calamity not to dream. It's not a disaster to be unable to capture your ideal, but it is a disaster to have no ideal to capture. It's not a disgrace not to reach the stars, but it's a disgrace to have no stars to reach for. Not failure, but low aim is sin." end of part one. We're good? Okay, part two. Part two is, I don't want to spend, you never know what I'm going to do with time. Let me just fool around with it and we'll see. Maybe I'll give you three ingredients, not four. But let me just talk a little bit about the importance and power of habit, because that's important. Let's say I gave you a bunch of recommendations. Let's say we spent the next 3 days in an intensive workshop on the psychology of change. We talk about strategies and the various ways the psychologists try to help people learn to work on change and how to go from pre-contemplation to contemplation to action. Pre-contemplation is, in the current theory of change, you're not even thinking about changing. And then how do you go from not even thinking, from pre-akara sache to contemplation to actually thinking and then to actually action. And it's really interesting stuff. So here's what would happen after the 3-day intensive workshop on change. Here's what the research shows. A third of you would go back to your day-to-day life, just like a third of us or many of us after Yom Kippur will likely go back to our regular world fundamentally unchanged. That's just human nature. It's hard to change. The second of the three groups will change, but usually New Year's resolutions are gone within a month to 2 months. It's just human nature. Very few people around today who, you know, had New Year's resolutions in January 1st of 2015 still are keeping to what they really resolved to change. And we all have al chetz to say in the coming weeks, right? We're not gonna like be doing the al chetz or thinking about what we want to change about ourselves and say, no, we're so perfect. We did this last year. No need for Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah this year. It's just not human nature. Human nature, it's hard to sustain change. Then there's the third group in the research. That change is something that is truly permanent. Not 100% of the time. There's usually setbacks, but the essence of change is that there's going to be real, profound, permanent change on some of the areas you're trying to work on. What differentiates group one from group two to group three? What is it about that third group that gets into change? It's about habit. It's about somehow ritualizing the change. That's what these 40 days are about. It's the habit of Elul, the habit of search, the habit of cheshbon nefesh, of a self-examination, or like Yaakov told his family and his army in the preparation for Esav, for the meeting with Esav. Who are you? Where are you going? What are you going to do with what you have? Important stuff to do in life, tied to happiness, tied to success, etc. So that's the essence of what the research shows. You have to ritualize. What does that look like? What it looks like is, I'll give you one example. Have you had lectures here, count your blessings lectures on gratitudes or anything like that? So gratitude, to the extent that you bring gratitude into your life changes. Happiness, but it's very, very hard to do it. Happiness levels go up, health improves, sleep improves. If you, before you went to sleep tonight, disciplined yourself to think about two or three things from your life that you're really grateful for, count your blessings. Okay? And you taught yourself to do it, especially if you're having trouble falling asleep, three things will happen. You'll fall asleep more quickly, you'll sleep more deeply, and you'll feel more rested the next day. It's the power of gratitude. A lot of really solid research on it. The problem is, gratitude is hard. Because we get used to the most spectacular things in the world that we should be incredibly grateful for. Even to be grateful for a room like this. To be living in a country where a publicly funded university, part of the city university system, that we could all sit down as Orthodox Jews and have a nice space and be able to have people come in and to be able to have shiurim and Shabbos. That's amazing. You know, when I travel to different parts of the world, that's just not done. It's frowned upon. It's not just because of numbers. It's a real gift that you're living in a place that allows you to think about how to integrate your values with general society. That's an amazing gift. Anytime I travel, it's something that I start to appreciate more and more. I have some amazing stories about that, but not for now. Okay. So here's what the way to ritualize bringing gratitude into your life. Again, we tend to be least grateful to those we owe the most to. So it's usually a count your blessing exercise. Friday night, you go around the table, one thing from the week you're grateful for. Okay, some people do that, and it gets a lot of people nauseous, but it's not a bad thing to do. When women light the candles, think about something from the week you're grateful for. I know that tefillah is supposed to be, you know, third hodah, but I'm talking about ways of on top of that to bring it in a way that really makes sense. Let me give you an example of how ritualizing it makes a difference, and then I'll move on to the final two categories. My main area in life, my main area in my profession is trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder. I was on the team that helped to develop the diagnosis, the DSM-4 diagnosis, and I get invited to a lot of places after traumatic events, not, you know, like Sri Lanka after the tsunami and to the Gulf. Actually, I was just in Houston because of the flooding there. I go all over the world to do interventions to help people who are traumatized in different ways. As a result of that, I spent a lot of time in Eretz Yisrael, especially when there's a very big, so after Har Nof massacre, I spent some time with the mental health people in the community there. So during the height of the Second Intifada, where there were bombings every day, there was a team of 40 therapists. They were the death notification people. They're the ones who had to go around the country when somebody lost a father, mother, son, sister, brother, wife, or husband, and they had to say, your son was just killed. Your daughter was just killed, your father, whatever. Can you think of a worse job in the world? And then they'd have to stay with them. And they were burning out. They know much more about trauma than I do, but they needed somebody from the outside to just spend time with them. So I flew into Israel. The Gemara says, "Ein chavish matar atzmo mi beis ha'asurim." You can't free yourself from your own prison. These therapists knew much more about trauma than I ever could hope to. Or would want to hope to. But they needed somebody from the outside. So I had an incredibly intense couple of weeks there. And I was about to fly back to America, but the Lord, Chief Rabbi Sachs, had invited me to be the speaker every 2 years in Bournemouth, England. He had a rabbinic conference for the rabbis in England under his command, and they have a retreat, and he invited me to be the visiting scholars. And you know, so I was going straight from this horrendous 2 weeks of being exposed to the horrible bombings, and there were many, many bombings during the 2 weeks that I was there, and now I was going to rush to the airport to go to this. Actually, there was a thing called rabbinic cricket on the schedule. That's the thing that I remember most about those 2 days in Bournemouth. It was a bunch of bearded rabbis who played cricket on the lawns overlooking the ocean. I think it could be a televised sport. It was amazing. So I'm in the taxi leaving Yerushalayim on the way to Ben Gurion to catch a plane to Heathrow. And I remembered that a good friend had invited me to their daughter's wedding in Yerushalayim. I said no, the connections were a little bit too tight, so I said no. But as I'm leaving Yerushalayim, I think, you know what, you only live once, let's go for it. So I tell the cab driver, I'll pay you for your waiting time, take me to this hotel. And there's a hotel, I don't even remember exactly where it is, but the chuppah was going on, it was outside. And I figure I'd run in, say mazel tov, and run back to catch the plane to Heathrow. So I run in, I find out the chuppah is in the back on the yard. And it's perfect temperature, it's 70 degrees. And the sun is setting over the Chalmot of Yerushalayim. Literally, the chuppah says the sun is setting over that magnificent scene of the ancient walls of the old city. On top of that, it was the happiest chassid and kala I ever saw in my life. Literally, the kala was jumping with joy. It was amazing. And then another miracle was nobody had their cell phones on. Another miracle. It was probably one of the most spiritual moments in my life. And I was like, everybody there is crying tears of happiness. So I was so happy I went. I run out. I barely catch the plane to watch rabbinic cricket. I get back to JFK just before Shabbos. And I'm sitting down with my wife and my family, totally emotionally exhausted. Not from cricket, but from the two weeks in Yerushalayim. And my wife turns to us and says, okay, count your blessings. One thing from the week you're grateful for. And I wanted to kill her. I wanted to kill her. I said, that's for other people, please. I just want to sleep. I'm jet lagged. I'm emotionally drained. And she's great. She very patiently said, fine, you don't have to. And she goes around to the kids. Each of the kids do the one thing from the week they're grateful for. And I had forgotten about the wedding. And I was going to pass, but then I remembered the wedding. I think I would have forgotten about it forever. And as I shared with my wife and children that magnificent moment as the sun was setting over the ancient walls of Yerushalayim with the happiest Chassid and Kala I ever saw, that intense spiritual moment, I almost felt it shifting from short-term memory to long-term memory. That's the power of ritualizing. So that's goal two. Habit. How do you bring it to a habit? The power of being minyan, or the power of learning, even though you're out of Israel now and it's hard to do something. The power of finding out what are your goals and how am I going to ritualize it in some ways. The power of these 40 days. Because without these 40 days, other religions don't necessarily have 40 days like this. 40 days of introspection and connection and all that kind of stuff. Ingredient number three. I know it's probably getting people upset when I keep looking at my watch. Is that annoying for me to look at my watch? Okay. Don't worry. We're fine. We have plenty of time. Okay. Ingredient number three. I could keep you all day with ingredient number three. Ingredient number three is about persistence. All the research on grit and persistence. I know how many of you have learned the work of Angela Duckworth. So what Angela Duckworth finds is that persistence is a much better predictor of success in life than your GPA or than your SATs or your MCATs or your LSATs. Being able to have grit is a predictor of just about anything in life. Being able to stay in things for the long run in spite of whatever's going on. That's a huge ingredient of change. I wish I had time to really develop this with you, this fascinating research and fascinating practical implications for it. But instead, I'm just going to tell you one medrash. One medrash on persistence, because a medrash or a story goes into your right hemisphere, you absorb it better. It's a medrash hagadol. My guess is many of you won't know it. Some of you might, so it'll be Chazara. But it's a not so well-known medrash about a story that everybody knows about, the story of Rachel and Akiva, or of Akiva. But listen to this medrash hagadol. Rav Akiva, it's the night before, he's supposed to go off to kindergarten to learn Aleph-Beis, the 40-year-old, not Rav Akiva, but the 40-year-old Akiva, the future giant. And in a very human way, he goes over to Rachel, he says, wait a second, you want me to go and sit next to little children? Basically, you want me to go to kindergarten, I picture, you know, those little chairs you have to sit in. And you want me to hang out with little 6-year-olds and 5-year-olds? They're going to tease me. Okay? I mean, the Midrash doesn't say teasing. Basically, they're going to give me a hard time. How could I do it? And she says, I got you. I hear. Let's go to the Shuk. Go to the Shuk. He says, now what, Rachel? Let's buy a donkey. Not any old donkey. It's a donkey with a spinal stenosis, a curvature right in its back. He has no idea why she wants to do it, but he's a smart man. Even before he learned how to read, she takes him home. He says, now what? She takes the flower pot. She puts it in the crevice of the donkey's back, and they plant cress, a very fast-growing plant. He says, now what? Go to sleep. Wakes up. You now have flowering plant in the middle of the donkey's back. She's got to the Shuk. She goes to the Shuk. Everybody is teasing Rav Akiva like you can't believe. They're taunting him. They're screaming at him. Look at that crazy man with the donkey and the flower pot. Children are taunting. Men, women, fine. Next day, what do you want from me now, Rachel? Back to the Shuk. The Medrash says there was still teasing. It was a little bit less. But here's where the Medrash becomes amazing from the psychology of change. Third day, he goes to the Shuk. And a child asks his father, what's that weird scene? Donkey, 40-year-old man, crest growing out of the flower pot. So the father answers, no, listen, there are two kinds of donkeys in the world. There are two kinds of donkeys. One is a regular donkey, and then there are donkeys that have flower pots in the back with crest growing out of it. Because it's okay. No teasing that day. Medrash goes on to say, the next day, Rav Akiva packs his lunchbox, metaphorically, and he and his son go to start Cheder to start his epic journey. What's the take-home message on the psychology of change? Change is often tough at the beginning. And it's often tempting to give up. Something worthwhile is often going to be extremely difficult. That's the nature of change. But the ability to confront the tough times with persistence and not giving up is a core ingredient. Final ingredient. I started with Elul as search. Now we're going to do Elul backwards. What's Elul backwards, everybody? Lulei. We're going to talk about the if-onlys in life. The changes in life. Okay? The change that comes by embracing mistakes and difficulties. Elul is Lulei. How do you handle the Luleis? Point number one. It's a point you might have heard. You might have learned Alei Shur on this. You just heard it in your time in Israel. The word chet, the word for sin in Hebrew, has a whole different psychological meaning than it does in the Christian world. Or in the Muslim world, for that matter. We view sin not as a sign of evil. What does the word chet mean, everybody? It means to miss the mark, right? So it says in Nach, the archers of Sheva Binyamin unerringly hit the bullseye, lo yachti. That's a game changer. When you see a chet as missing the mark, you don't beat yourself up. You don't start saying to yourself, I'm an evil, horrible, awful person because I did this that I shouldn't have done and this. All our chets, we're not about literally beating ourselves up. We don't believe that. It's about saying, I missed the mark. Tshuva is a do-over. When you see that as a challenge instead of as a threat, all the research shows you do much, much better. Your working memory, your executive functioning isn't taken up with guilt, which is not productive or constructive. There's such a thing as constructive guilt. That's a whole other talk, okay? So that's the key final point. And I'll just illustrate it with a study, and then I'll end with the final story. And then we'll have some time, as I was asked, for questions. You ready? Okay. Here's the study. The neurosurgeon study, okay? Anybody here pre-med? Nobody pre-med? Anybody want to admit to being pre-med other than you? Okay. If I asked this question at Stern or at YU, the whole room would have raised their hands. Okay. So here's the deal. I guess it's smart to not admit that you're pre-med because then you want to manage expectations. I hear it. Okay. How many of you are thinking one chance out of 1,000 that you might be pre-med? No. Okay. Life has changed. Okay. How many pre-dent? No, interesting. So what are people going to go dental? That okay. What are people going to go into nowadays? What? Yeah, I love it. It's a great way to live a life of poverty but a life of meaning. It's a life of meaning, okay? Okay. No, it's not true. Actually, you could make somewhat adequate living, okay? Okay. And life's not about money. That's a whole other lecture. There's no connection between money and happiness. Actually, the connection is between meaning and happiness. Psychology is a wonderful, wonderful field. It really is. As long as you don't have to support your family. Okay. So, no. I'm married to a lawyer. A lawyer. She may make me do count your blessings, but she also does well, thank God. Okay, so here we go. You ready? Here's the neurosurgeon study. Okay. University of Pennsylvania sociologist in the medical school, his name is Dr. Bosk. Now, to become a neurosurgeon, here's what you have to do. 4 years of med school, 5 years of general surgery training, another number of years of central nervous system surgery training, then subspecialty till finally you're operating on the brain. Takes a long, long time. You're not finished till you're well into your 30s. Within this very select subgroup, what Dr. Bosk wanted to look at, what differentiates the top 1% of neurosurgeons, the ones who are so good after all that training that they have the fewest deaths? People just don't die under their knife. Maybe they'll have a death once in a while, but they have the best outcomes. From the bottom 1%, who after all of those years just are literally so bad they get fired from their hospitals. Top 1%. So you might think, well, what predicts being in the top 1%? Maybe some of the three first ingredients we talked about? Maybe that? Nope. Manual dexterity? No. Medical school you went to? No. Surgical residency program you went to? No. MCAT scores? No. Nothing like that. The number one predictor of being in the top 1% is how you handled your mistake. If a top 1% neurosurgeon had a patient die under his or her watch, they would not go home till they changed the setback to feedback, till they had the do-over of the chait, like we were talking about before. They would go to the animal lab, do the surgery over and over again on those poor animals. They'd go to the library, did I miss an unpublished abstract? They'd call the leading neurosurgeons around the world, could I have done anything different? They often would stay up all night until they figured out, how am I going to do it better the next time? Not with a neurotic kind of perfectionism, but in a way that it energized them to do a better job the next time. If you read Dr. Bosk's interviews of the bottom 1%, that was amazing, the bottom 1%, because they'd say things, well, sure, the patient died. If you had such terrible nurses helping you in the OR, well, they killed the patients. Or, you know, the lighting. How could I see into a brain with this terrible lighting? It was all about externalizing blame. That's Elul Izlule. There's study after study after study now showing that perhaps the most important ingredients of change and of internalizing change is being able to own up to when you mess up without seeing it as a sign that you're a terrible, horrible person, but instead seeing it as the do-over that I was talking about before. Let me end with a final story. I have a million final stories to tell you, but to leave time for questioning, for questions, I'll... Anybody, who here has heard me speak before? Oh, okay. So I can make a lot of things up. Okay. I'm going to do the story of the three questions. This is a little bit of a subtle story. And the take-home message, like if I was doing this for a class, I'd ask you to write a little one-page essay on what this has to do with the psychology of change in a deeper way. But I want you thinking, because when you think, you own things more. Story about a shiva visit I paid to a good friend of mine, whose father died, but was an amazing man. He'd been a rabbi for many years, a brilliant, brilliant Talmud Chacham, but an amazing pastoral rabbi. Was unbelievable in his ability to help people and his compassion. And after a long, productive life, he died. He happened to leave behind, many of his children were very respected physicians. So go to pay a shiva call. My friend is sitting down, his siblings are sitting down. And into the room walks a very distinguished-looking man. I have no idea. Nobody in the shiva house knew who he was. But immediately, there's total silence in the room because these brothers who are physicians are looking in awe. Imagine if your number one role model, okay? Imagine if your number one person who you most wanted to be like. So in this case, it was one of the leading physicians in the world. This guy was the master of cardiac bypass surgery. He's the Gadol Hadar in cardiac bypass surgery. And he walks into the room, they had no idea why he was there. Like, what? This guy is not even Jewish. The guy sees they're shocked. They know they can't get up out of respect. You're not allowed to when you're sitting shiva. But they literally are looking in awe. And the whole room becomes quiet. It's a very distinguished looking guy with a lot of charisma. And he says, look, he says, I'm not Jewish. He says, I never paid a condolence call before. I don't even know how to do it. But I figure I'll tell you how your father saved my life and how everything I've accomplished over the last number of years is because of him, and then I'll leave. Is that okay? Is that the way to do a condolence? Well, I said, yeah. Okay. So everybody's listening, and he says the following. He says, 10 years earlier, he was doing surgery, bypass surgery in his operating room. His cell phone rang. It was the terrible news that he had a brother much younger than him who died suddenly of a massive MI, a massive heart attack, never been sick a day in his life. Horrible tragedy. Had young children. But to make it even worse, here this doctor is routinely saving the lives of men and women double his brother's age. And here his own brother, he couldn't save. He kept thinking, I killed my brother. He had no reason to think, but you know, guilt is irrational very often. And he takes a leave of absence, he comes back, but with every stitch he says to himself, I killed my brother, I killed my brother, I killed my brother. It's just not good. He's going for all kinds of help to different mental health professionals, nothing's working. Finally, he says to himself, you know, I remember 10 years ago, this is 20 years before the shiva, I did bypass surgery on a very holy spiritual man. Incredibly holy man. And he's a rabbi. He said, let me go through my records, and maybe he'll talk to me. Maybe he seemed very wise to me. Maybe even though I'm not Jewish, he'll talk to me. So he gets this rabbi's number from his records, and he calls him. He says, look, I don't know if you even remember me. I'm Dr. Sussi. He said, are you kidding? You saved my life. I've been living for the last 10 years on your surgery. I'm feeling great. And he did. He gave him 20 more years. Or helped give him 20 more years, right? So he tells him the problem. He says, Rabbi, can I come talk to you? So the rabbi says, of course, please. He goes and he schleps out to this rabbi's neighborhood, tells him what happened. The rabbi says, look. He says, every human being has a soul. Every soul has a unique spark. With the death of your brother, you lost the unique spark of your soul. I can't give it back to you. Nobody in the world can. You have to find it by yourself. You have to go through a search process, an Elul process, to find it by yourself. But I'll tell you what we'll do. Go home now. He was sort of semi-retired. He couldn't stand operating anymore. He says, go and read. Use your spare time now. Read everything you can. Come to me once a week. We'll sit down and we'll talk about the readings and what you learned from them. And the doctor loves it. It becomes the high point of his week. 2-3 months go by. He loves going to the rabbi's house. They talk about everything. Everything imaginable based on the doctor's readings. But it's still not helping. 3-4 months into the process, the doctor comes skipping into the rabbi's room. He says, I got it. Don't have to come back anymore. Going back full time to the hospital. They were dying to take me. I'm their number one moneymaker. We're finished. Thank you, rabbi. So the rabbi says, what is it? What happened? He said, it's a short story I read. Short story. You could Google it. Not now. You could Google it later. It's called The Three Questions. Nobody hears on cell phones. Not a single person has a cell phone. What's wrong with you guys? That's amazing. Is that like out of respect or out of just, that's so nice. It's very, very rare. Okay. Very nice. I commend all of you. You better check for your messages, though. Your texts? You don't know? Okay, excellent. Or are you checking without looking? Is there some magical new third brain that people are second brain? Okay. So, okay. That was the part I skipped to talk a little bit about that, but I'm very impressed. Not even one person. There's got to be people with cell phones underneath that's subtly checking. No even guilty smiles. It's incredible. He said it's a Tolstoy short story. You could Google it. It's called Tolstoy, The Three Questions. And it ends with the following statement. That when you have somebody in front of you, you have to ask yourself three questions. Question number one is, what's the most important time? We all know the answer to that question. What's the most important time? Now. Lo achshav emasai, not now, when. Question number two is, what's the most important thing, most important activity when you have somebody in front of you? Do chesed. Olam chesed yibana. The world is built on acts of loving kindness. That's question number two, is do chesed. Most important thing. And question number three is, who is the most important person? And the answer to that is, the most important person is the person in front of you. That somehow changed the doctor. He immediately goes back to work. If you were a fly on his operating room right now, let's say we were looking at the observatory, went on a class trip or a college trip to see him do surgery today in Manhattan, okay? Here's what you'd see as he preps for the surgery. If you want to operate with him, you have to do one thing. He doesn't care who you are. You could be the anesthesiologist. You could be the cardiovascular fellow. You could be the nurse anesthetist. He doesn't care. 10, 15 person operating team. He's the head. He's the head surgeon. They have to form a circle around him. They all hold hands. And he screams out, what's the most important time? And they all have to scream. They want to operate with him. They have to scream out to him, now! What's the most important thing? Do good. Who's the most important person? The person in front of us. Let's operate. In those questions lies the three ingredients we talked about, the four ingredients we talked about. And the core of change, the core of Elul as search, the core of Elul as Lule, and the other couple of ingredients, including habit and persistence. And may we all be zoche as you go into the continuation of this 40-day period to truly understand these ingredients of change and to be able to engage in constructive, healthy, happy change. Thank you, everybody.
I know that everybody has complicated schedules. We still have free hour, but I want to first thank Dr. Lefkowitz again for coming out to speak to us. We'll take a few minutes of Q&A. We'll wrap up at around 1:15, 1:20 to make sure that those who need to get to class can get to class. There will also be 1:25 mincha right here, so we'll wrap up at 1:20. But we have a few minutes. Don't miss this opportunity. If you have any questions on the topic, throw them out.
You want to talk about your roommates? No? How do you change? No. You want to talk about your friends? About yourself? You know, why you? I'd be all over me. Everybody would be yelling at me, screaming, disagreeing, showing me sources why I'm wrong. Come on, guys.